Word of mouth.
Heaven. I'm in heaven.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. All movie genres go in and out of fashion, the Western, the rom-com, the biopic, slasher movies. But as historian Richard Barrios notes, the official notice of fini has been hung on musicals at least 6 times. And again, they managed to rise up singing. But why? Why in the depths of the Depression did 42nd Street triumph? What made Sound of Music and Oliver hits while Americans rioted in the streets? How did Les Miserables become an international phenomenon in the age of Hollywood pyrotechnics and reality TV? Barrios proposes that behind their deceptively simple, glimmering facades, musicals have a place in American culture beyond pure escapism. In his new book, Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter, is full of razzly-dazzly hits, dismal flops, sharp criticism, and enough insider gossip to make the case really interesting. Richard Barrios, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what do you say when people say, ugh, it's a musical, I hate musicals?
Oh, I tell them they're not alone, that this sort of thing happens a lot. Musicals divide people as much as politics do, really.
You spend a lot of time in the book on what makes them work and what does not. So let's just focus on a few. Why don't we look at Singin' in the Rain, and we've got a little music to set the tone.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain.
Okay, Richard Barrios, what made that musical work?
More than anything else, I think, and there's many great things to choose from in it, but it's a musical where the script matters as much as the songs and the dances. It's an incredibly witty script, and it is a way of sort of paying tribute to all of the movie musicals that came before it, because it starts at the very beginning of the sound era. So it encompasses all of movie musicals, and it does so very wittily and kind of nasty, too, occasionally, which I enjoy.
So how about the ones that didn't work? You can take your pick.
I can go to paint your wagon. That's always a good target to hang to hang bullseyes on. They got a lot of people who could not sing, like Lee Marvin and Clint Eastwood. They spent way too much money by going to a remote part of Oregon that was prone to flooding, so they chose the location very poorly. And they tried to make it really hip and current, and it was neither of those things. So it was a total misfire of the wrong material, the wrong people, the wrong intentions, the wrong amount of money spent. So it was kind of a perfect storm.
Well, there is a special and precise bond that you write about between musicals and their audience, a mutually admiring kinship, you say, unintelligible to outsiders and quite fragile. When either side violates it, crises occur. What are some of the elements that go into that plot? It isn't always that someone has a great singing voice. It's not always a plausible plot. Some great singers and duds. Give us some of these elements.
It's sort of an intangible. It has to do with understanding how music and words can connect and then how they can be transmitted to an audience for the maximum amount of comprehension and empathy. You get something like Judy Garland, a great singer, singing Over the Rainbow, and it's a situation that people can understand, a girl from Kansas longing for a world of color and magic.
There's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
That's an example of where it all comes together because it's all been thought out. And the audience is always part of the equation. And sometimes movies leave out the audience and how they might respond. And that's when a movie musical does not matter, when it forgets about its audience.
Well, you just led me to something that also makes this book so interesting, inside view of how films are produced. Over the Rainbow almost didn't make it into The Wizard of Oz.
At one point, a number of MGM producers wanted to cut it. They said, why should Judy go around singing in the barnyard? Imagine what that would have been like.
But back to this point that it has to matter in order to be successful. Don't all films have to matter to be successful?
Well, with escapism, mattering is sort of a relative concept. It doesn't have to be totally connected with current events, for example, but it has to offer something beneath the surface, I think, some sort of resonance, strike some sort of responsive chord. And that was one of the reasons that so many big musicals like Paint Your Wagon and Hello, Dolly, coming in at the end of the 1960s, seemed so clueless, because there was so much difficult going on in the world. You had Vietnam, you had riots in the United States, and here come these movies with sort of mindless optimism that seemed really willfully offensive, even, because it seemed to totally disregard what was going on. And a musical can maybe make people happy in a difficult situation or an unhappy situation, but it can't be oblivious.
Well, even if My Fair Lady, Hello, Dolly, Camelot in the 1960s were tone deaf, there are movies like 42nd Street, which is a great hit during the Depression. Doesn't a musical have to be out of date somewhat to transport us?
Well, 42nd Street was as timely as a film could be, because it came in right as President Roosevelt was being inaugurated, and Warner Brothers promoted it with Roosevelt's own slogan, New Deal. They promoted it as a New Deal in entertainment. And it gave Depression-weary audiences hope, because here's this totally unknown girl, Ruby Keeler, who becomes a star. And it said, well, if this nobody can make it big, maybe you can get out of the Depression too.
Hmm.
I got it!
Well, what is it? A penny?
A nickel?
Will you hold your horses and let me get the dirt off?
A dime! We're in the money! We're in the money!
And following the 60s, of course, the 1970s, a time of still continuing struggle in the U.S., not a great age for the movie musical. But you single out one, Cabaret, what, 72, 74? I can't recall.
72.
Why did it work?
Well, for one thing, it paid attention to the world around it. It connected a lot of the unrest going on in the entire world by that time, from the 60s and early 70s, with the rise of Nazi Germany. And it did so in a very sort of hard-edged, unsentimental way. There weren't nuns defeating these Nazis or anything like that. It seemed relevant. And with Bob Fosse in charge, it was very hard-edged. The editing was much sharper than most films had tried to be musically before then. So it really connected with audiences. But then after that, musicals just sort of faded away. You had things like MAME and Lost Horizon, which seemed totally clueless. And something like that's going to alienate a large part of the population, and that's what happened.
MAME with Lucille Ball, a hit on television. What was it? The New York Times columnist Pauline Kael said about her.
Did she do her own singing, or was she dubbed by Dick Cavett?
While you can ponder that question, we'll listen to a little bit from Maybe This Time. This is Liza Minnelli's pretty transcendent performance in Cabaret.
Everybody loves a winner, so nobody loved me. Lady Peaceful, Lady Happy, that's what I long to be. Well, all the odds are there in my favor. Something's bound to begin. It's gotta happen, happen sometime. Maybe this time I'll win.
We're talking about this submerged movie genre that keeps resurfacing, the musical. Richard Barrios is with us. He worked in the music and film industry before turning to film history, and his new book is called Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter. Makes the case that musicals are surprisingly sophisticated bellwethers of American culture, taste preference, and even politics. I want to stay on that connection to the real world and look at musicals as one of the more integrated refuges in Hollywood for African Americans, for sexuality in the days of the Hays Code, the motion picture production code, and homosexuality on film. Why, Richard Barrios, do musicals get a pass in those forbidden places?
Well, I think part of it was because entertainment actually had higher profile gay and lesbian people and African Americans participating in them. And so many of the early musicals were backstage theatrical stories. And since these personalities were part of that life, it was sort of easier to bring them along. The very first musical film, as we now consider musicals, was The Broadway Melody, which opened early in 1929, and it featured very prominently a gay costume designer. Hmm. A few months after that, the early musical On With the Show, which was also a backstage story, featured the wonderful recording and stage performer Ethel Waters introducing the song Am I Blue and totally hitting it out of the ballpark.
I think
so. And this sort of continued on. It waxed and waned, but by the 1940s, you had Ethel Waters again with Lena Horne in the great musical Cabin in the Sky. You had the Nicholas Brothers and Lena Horne in Stormy Weather. And you had very covert but nevertheless detectable to people who understood gay presences in movies like Lady in the Dark and Broadway Rhythm, some of those things.
Well, let's hear just a little bit of that. This is Lena Horne singing Stormy Weather. Let's talk about the medium of film for a moment. Making things matter, as you point out, is not simply adapting a successful Broadway show for film, nor does it work the other way around. What is it specifically about the medium of film that makes it fly or not?
Well, one of the mistakes I think that a lot of live shows are making now that are adapted from movies is that they try to copy movie techniques onto the live stage. And these are two completely different mediums, and they should not be confused with one another. They should not overlap. And I wish they'd stop trying to adapt animated films into live stage shows. It doesn't really work. Lion King was good, and they should have stopped there.
Well, I was going to stop you on that because I would say Lion King did work. But the whole idea of the musical, it is pretty awkward and silly in its own way, right? I mean, I'm thinking
It can be.
Well, I'm thinking of that, you know, in the Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Did you ever see that movie?
Oh, yes.
Okay,
yes.
So you have the Scottish father who, you know, when his son, you hear the music start to swell and his son is posing like he's about to sing and he's saying, no, stop the music. There's not going to be any singing.
Exactly. And really, song cues and that sort of thing have been a target since the very beginning of musicals and sound in the late 1920s, even. You see some early musicals make fun of some of those conventions because they are silly. And let's face it, musicals do have to occupy their own particular world with a certain kind of suspension of disbelief.
Well, why do you think we're willing to suspend disbelief for a musical?
I think the best answer to that would come in the way that a really good musical can give the effect of making dreams seem tangible. They sort of tap into our subconscious and provide these brilliant, when they're done well, illustrations of what we dream about and what we think about. And, you know, to make fantasies seem real is quite an achievement. And musicals do it in a very specific way. And it's a way that the tenor of the times isn't always connected with, which is why they go in and out of fashion so much.
Well, we just scraped the surface, Richard Barrios, but I want to thank you so much for your time.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Richard Barrios is a film historian whose new book is called Dangerous Rhythm, Why Movie Musicals Matter. There's much more in his book, including some YouTube links to some of the great sequences in musical history. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org.